So, as Hans just said, the title of my talk is Asymptotic Expansions and Nonlinear Stability of Pauli Inflation Models. I suppose that tomorrow we'll hear more about asymptotic expansions in a broader context, in a talk by Lars Andersson, probably, and maybe in talks by others. So I can restrict myself to Pauli inflation models, one particular kind. Let me say that the talk is essentially based on recent work done by myself and Ellen Randall, like 2 months ago. Okay, so I'll start with a short introduction about power law inflation. So what we consider is a space-time M, and a metric which will always be G tilde, and a scalar field phi. We suppose that the metric satisfies the Einstein equations, and the right-hand side is the energy momentum tensor of the scalar field. However, the scalar field is nonlinear. We have introduced here in the energy momentum tensor a potential, which implies that the scalar field equations become this nonlinear wave equation here. Okay. So for power law inflation, we make one choice. This is done now and for all. The potential is chosen as a constant times the exponential function of minus kappa lambda phi. Kappa is just this common constant like square root 8 pi c g whatever. Lambda is a positive constant which we choose to be less than square root 2. And phi is the scalar field. So you might ask, why do I call models like these power law inflation models when a potential is an exponential function? And I think I can explain this. So when we consider the simplest models, namely models that are homogeneous and isotropic, then among those, the simplest one again is the one that has the number 2 here. So the metric is minus this t squared plus some constant that depends on the constants we've chosen for the potential, the v0 and the lambda, times the function t to the power of 4 over lambda squared, times the spatial metric, which is flat here. So the scale factor, which is commonly noted as A, is here a power, I mean, displays a power law. So it's t to the power of 2 over lambda squared. The universe this solution describes is expanding because the derivative of the scale factor is positive, but moreover the expansion is accelerated because the second derivative is bigger than zero, which comes from our choice of the constant lambda. Lambda was chosen less than square root of 2, so this factor here is bigger than zero. The term inflation itself usually refers to accelerated expansion in the early stages, in the early development of the universe. But here I'll be only concerned with future asymptotics. But as I said, also in the future, it's accelerated expansion. Okay, the main theorem I'll talk about is put in one sentence like the following. The model here, the model 2, the simplest homogeneous and isotropic model, is nonlinearly stable without any symmetry assumptions. But of course, I have to be more specific here. And that's how. So what we do, so let's formulate the theorem like the following. We consider this exponential potential and Einstein scalar field equation, but we choose now the constant lambda in the exponent in a very particular way. We choose it like square root of 2 times square root of d over d plus 2, where d is an integer number and it's supposed to be even. So we don't let lambda be arbitrary, but we chose it from a sequence of numbers that, as we see here, converges to square root of 2. All these numbers are less than square root of 2 by definition. For those models, we consider smooth Cauchy initial data for the Einstein scalar field equations. And we choose this data in the following way. It should be close to the model, to the data of the model we have seen before, to the homogeneous and isotropic model. Then we get the following. The initial data evolves into a power law inflation model that is geodesically complete to the future. And secondly, we get global coordinates such that the metric takes a particular form which can be captured by expansions at infinity. Meaning that if we write the metric like that here, we get for the spatial part here some power as before t to the 4 over lambda squared and a sum of terms, coefficients that are independent of t times powers of t that decay. The first term is here, I mean in the sum itself, is independent of t.
So you will explain us those funny numbers, will you? Or
which numbers?
Is t over d?
Oh yes, oh yes, oh yes, definitely. So phi has a similar expansion and the coordinate system is not really Gaussian or something, but to the zeroth order, the alpha is independent of t. So this is just a function of x. Okay. So for the model we saw before, the homogeneous and isotropic model, this expansion becomes very simple. Namely, yeah, I've written it out here term by term, just to see it. The first term, the zeroth term is the delta and all others are zero. So what do other models do? Let's go to the next level of complexity and consider homogeneous and isotropic solutions different from this simple one, which had the number 2. This is how they look like. It's already quite a mess. It's somehow the ultimate thing you can do in power law inflation when you want to have explicit expressions. The only thing you need to see here in this mess is that if m, which is just a parameter, nothing of significance, if m is 0, then most of this mess is gone and we get the simple power law inflation model, the homogeneous and isotropic one we had before. So if one considers the others, where this m is not 0, then one can try to put it in to make an expansion like we have above, and one sees that the zeroth coefficient is again the delta. Then there are many, many zeros up to coefficient number 3 plus d, but this one then is not 0. What follows from this is that the homogeneous and isotropic models here are attracted by the special model we have seen before. So this is the attractor for the general solution. And the same is true for all homogeneous solutions. But for the real general solution without any symmetries, we cannot expect anything like that because in general, this coefficient here will not be the delta. Meaning that the general solution of a general power law inflation model will not converge to this isotropic and homogeneous model. So stability doesn't mean stability in the sense of converging to, but it means somehow stability of the future global behavior. And this will be precise in a moment. So somehow this distance between metrics doesn't grow unboundedly. The distance is also not really distance, but it's also conformal, but I hope we will see that. So formulating this in a more precise manner, we use the following definition. We call this power law model space-time m g tilde phi, we call it asymptotically simple to the future, if there exists a positive function omega such that we can make a conformal rescaling of the metric g tilde and obtain a metric g dot or prime or whatever that is, defined by omega to the power of 2 plus d of the original metric, and we also get some rescaling of the scalar field. And the requirement is that those conformally transformed quantities can be smoothly extended through the hypersurface omega equals zero, which we then identify as the conformal boundary of the space-time, and we denote it with square plus.
What so is k and lambda here?
Sorry?
What are k and lambda? I'm sorry.
K was this physical stuff, like square root of 8 pi, which is on the right-hand side of the energy momentum tensor.
Okay.
And lambda is the constant we have in the potential. Maybe I should try to put it somewhere.
I'm confused. So I thought d was a differential. So what is d then?
Is
a constant.
D was the number in the theorem. So yeah, maybe I find it here somewhere, and I can just keep it. Yeah. So this was the form of the potential, and d is okay, always stands okay. always for dimension here,
thanks.
Or I mean some number. So you might ask, why does the conformal factor carry such a strange exponent here? This comes simply from the idea that the homogeneous and isotropic power law inflation model should be asymptotically simple. I mean, that's what is the definition. I mean, that's the model for the definition. So we can carry this through and see that we need some factor that's not too here for this power. The conformal boundary here is space-like. This is implied by the definition. Well, not very difficult to see. So this asymptotic simplicity is how we capture now the global behavior, so to speak. So when we say future global behavior is stable, we mean something like that initial data evolves into an asymptotically simple solution whenever we choose the initial data close to the data of the homogeneous and isotropic solution. What we actually will prove in this talk is the theorem in this version. There will be some terms unexplained at the moment, but I hope everything will be clear, the derivation then. So what we will look at eventually is the conformal initial value problem. And the idea of the theorem is that this conformal initial value problem is well posed in the context of Einstein's equations with scalar field and the above potential. Okay, but I think this will be clear later. So the main tool we need for the following is Kaluza-Klein reduction in a slightly simplified version. So what we consider is a big manifold, M hat, which is the product of a manifold M and a Lie group G. In general, we can consider principal fiber bundles, so that's why I will often call M the base manifold or the base space. So here, M is supposed to be four-dimensional, and we use coordinates x mu ranging, as always, from 0 to 3. And G is a d-dimensional Lie group, and the thetas here denote d right invariant one-forms. We choose a metric on this total space M hat in a very particular way, and I will call that very often a 4 plus d split. 4 plus d meaning that this term here is four-dimensional living on the base space, and this lives on the group, so to speak. Note that the metric here, the g and the xi, both depend only on the coordinates of the base space. So this is what we will use quite often, and again, I'll call that a 4 plus d split. Usually the xi, see the coefficients xi, are called scalar multiplets, and from those we'll define a scalar field by the following. So we define e to the phi as the square root of the determinant of the xi here, so that we can write xi is some exponential term, including this phi, and a zeta, where the zeta has determinant equal to 1. Okay. So the whole business in Kaluza-Klein is often about expressing curvatures living on the big space by using the curvature, the metric, or other things on the parts, the base space, on the fibers, so to speak. You don't have to remember those formulas, that's just how they look like in the present context. What we'll do here is we will use the phi. I maybe want to point you to the definition again. What we will use is the phi defined here from the scalar multiplet in order to conformally transform the metric of the base space. If we do that and denote by this R tilde the curvature of the conformally rescaled metric, we get again some formulas that are quite messy, but they simplify considerably if we now make two basic assumptions. Namely, first, we assume that the Lie group is abelian, and second, we assume that the part of the scalar multiplet here that had determinant 1 is covariantly constant. So this will plug in, and secondly, and this is the very important step, we assume that the total space here is a space-time that satisfies the Einstein vacuum equations with cosmological constant lambda, which I write down like here. What we get then is the following. Just plugging in the stuff here. Still not obvious, but the second one looks really nice. This is already very similar to what we had before. Wave operator and some exponential term here. So what we do is we simply redefine our phi here just by a constant. And what we obtain here is then that the Einstein tensor of the conformally rescaled metric looks like the energy momentum tensor of a scalar field phi, including some potential, and the scalar field itself satisfies the nonlinear wave equation, where this potential is, in fact, what we had before, exponential function of a very strange power here, times phi. So what follows here, what we've shown is that if the big space satisfies Einstein vacuum equations with the cosmological constant lambda, then the space M, the base space, together with the conformally rescaled metric of the first part and a scalar field, which was essentially this field here, then this is a power law inflation model. And I want to give this, I want to put here a schematic overview. So in order to summarize, big space on one side, Einstein vacuum with cosmological constant, and a 4 plus d split of the metric. On the other side, conformally transformed metric of the base space, and a scalar field coming from the phi, which was here. And this is a power law inflation model in 4 dimensions. Now, let's leave that. Let me give an example. So, as an example, consider the Sitter space-time in 4 plus d dimensions. So, and let's introduce somehow, I mean, this is automatically split in this 4 plus d way. Yeah, that's how it looks like. And now let's just try what it corresponds to in this correspondence here. So the scalar field phi here should be contained in the exponential fact, in the exponential here of the second part, which is the 2hx0, there is some 2 over d involved, so the phi is dh times x0, the x0 is the time component, so to speak. And the conformally rescaled metric contains the e to the phi, so e to the phi is just this part, times the first part, the metric on the base, so to speak, which is here. Okay, if you introduce new coordinates, quite simple, we obtain here, actually, that's the homogeneous and isotropic power law inflation model. Why? I mean, yeah, again, prime coordinate to a power 2 plus 4 over d, where this 2 plus 4 over d corresponds to the 2 over lambda squared we always had before, because the lambda had this strange formula. Questions so far? Okay.
So I came a bit late, so you probably told by the time already what is the basic thing you are trying to prove here. So would you mind?
Non-linear stability of power law inflation models. So how do we proceed in the proof? I've been told that oxidation is the opposite of reduction, so I must use this term here. So here, what we'll do is the following. We don't prove it directly. We go this detour, which we sketched here. We know a lot about nonlinear stability of the sitter. We know that this homogeneous and isotropic model corresponds to the sitter in this Kaluza-Klein way. So we can do a reduction here somehow. The only thing we have to do is to oxidize the equations and data to that level, make the proof on this 4 plus d level, and then reduce it down again. So that's how we will proceed now. I will not go step by step now like it's here. I will start with the top here, trying to recapitulate what is known about the sitter, stability of the sitter. I hope I don't interfere with your talk, Lars. But there's something needed for that, of course. So, we're now in the realm of Einstein vacuum equations with cosmological constant, positive. We consider an n plus 1 dimensional space-time, and it's chosen odd here, so that n plus 1 is even. That's the most complicated thing in the whole talk. It's always keeping track of what's even, what's odd. Okay, so n is odd, and we look at the metric in Gaussian coordinates. So, it has been proved that the Einstein vacuum equations with a cosmological constant admit power series of a certain type as formal solutions. And those power series look essentially like this here. So there is H is some constant which contains the cosmological constant and the dimension. There is some exponential here, and again some series which has these decaying exponential functions. This is essentially due to Alan Randall, based on work of Starobinsky, Pfeffer, and Graham, and others. So when we write down such a power series, then all coefficients are determined by the Einstein equations, with two exceptions. The first coefficient, the zero coefficient, that she had a base zero, and actually the coefficient number n. So they encode somehow the free data. We call them A and B, A hat and B hat. So the data can be chosen in the following way. A is essentially arbitrary. It's a Riemannian metric, but otherwise arbitrary. B is a symmetric tensor that is trace-free and trace-less and divergence-free, trace-free, divergence-less, whatever. Yes, so both trace and divergence of it should vanish. Okay, that's the data, and in order to use that now, we use another result by Alan Randall. If the manifold M hat G hat is asymptotically simple and the sitter, so I'm not talking about asymptotic simplicity in the usual way, like the sitter asymptotically simple, then the above formal expansions are indeed asymptotic expansions of solutions. And this gives us a means of interpreting the free data here this A and B in a certain way, namely as initial data prescribed at conformal infinity. So what we have set up here is then a kind of conformal initial value problem. We have some conformal boundary. There we prescribe the initial data, and then we do the evolution. And it has been proved that this initial value problem is indeed well posed for Einstein vacuum with lambda. In particular, if we have given such initial data A and B on a manifold, which we call already square plus, then there exists a unique future asymptotically simple solution of Einstein equations with cosmological constant, whose conformal boundary is this square plus. This was proved by Helmut Friedrich for dimensions 4 and by Michael Anderson quite recently for all even dimensions. In addition to that, one can also discuss global nonlinear stability of this asymptotic simplicity, meaning that if data is sufficiently close to the sitter, then it's really globally, not only semi-globally to the future or to the past, so really globally close to the sitter. So globally asymptotically simply in the past and the future. So this well-posedness of the conformal initial value problem then is essentially synthesized by this sentence here. So any initial data close to the sitter evolves into an asymptotically simple solution that has an asymptotic expansion of the form we have here. Sorry?
So when you say close, so the main theorem should be closed in the
scene. Closed? Where is closed?
Closed. I mean, the initial bit should be closed. So in the main theorem, you have C infinity topology, and these results is
infinity. It can be the same. I mean, you can use same topology. I mean,
but I mean, are these results also valid for some of the spaces?
I suppose so.
Yeah, they're reasonable.
Yeah,
right.
Should be.
Yeah, but you need something like H. 2n plus something.
I mean, as soon as the differentiability is high enough,
the more
you know,
very good.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. I want to keep that. Yeah. So this result, part of it, I mean, the series here, will now reduce to the four-dimensional level. So we have worked here, not yet, but now, we'll work with a 4 plus D split, so to speak. So our manifold here we had before is now of the form here, of the form like here, and the metric is supposed to have this 4 plus D split. And we also split the extrinsic curvature in the same way. Then we simply get from the asymptotic expansions we have here for Einstein vacuum with lambda, we get here asymptotic expansions for the parts. I mean, there's nothing nothing really deep in that. It's just written out in an acute way. And we can take this as an ansatz now again and put it into Einstein equations. I think I don't go into the details maybe here. This is too tedious. But just to give you a flavor, one gets one of those quite big recursive algebraic systems for the coefficients, which looks like that. That's not even all. You have to have other equations for the constraints, but that's the main part. The only thing I want you to see is that in the last two equations, when we compute the determinant of the coefficients here, so this is that one, then we get m minus d plus 3, m minus 2, d plus 3. M is the number of the coefficient in this expansion here. So the system thus determines effectively all coefficients, with the exception of the two where the determinant becomes singular. But in fact, since there is one other equation which I didn't write down here, this coefficient is also determined. So again, just to repeat, this leaves two unspecified coefficients in this algebraic series, namely the zeroth coefficient and the coefficient number d plus 3. So they are undetermined by the algebraic system and thus represent some kind of free data. In more detail, what we have here is just again by this 4 plus t split, free data in the metric, 2 times the 0 and the 3 plus t, and the same in the field. This free data is again like in this Kaluza-Klein correspondence in a close connection to the free data on the 4 plus t dimensional level with the a hat and b hat we had before here. So when we decompose the a and b, the initial data, according to this 4 plus t split, then I'm likely following, then we obtain that the free data here is in connection to the quantities that that appear in this split. The constraints here, the trace and the divergence, they are also reduced to the following two conditions. And the procedure, the idea is the same again. If we are in an asymptotically simple space-time, then again this set here can be considered as a conformal initial data set. And we'll now collect the information we have gathered to prove the theorem. So we'll prove essentially the well-postedness of the conformal initial value problem on for these power law inflation models. So we consider a manifold which we call Squared Plus with given tensors Aij, Bij, and fields AB, which are subject to the constraints which I had here. And we want to prove that this data, conformal initial data, uniquely evolves into an asymptotically simple space-time under the Einstein non-linear scalar field equations. So we make the first step in the schematics, we make this anti-reduction is oxidation. So the data we have given here corresponds to data on the 4 plus t level. Namely, we define a manifold square plus hat, which is just the product here of the square plus times the RD. And we construct tensors A hat and B hat according to these rules, to these 4 plus t split rules. So we have Cauchy data now on square plus hat on the 4 plus t level. We have seen in this Kaluza-Klein correspondence that the equations we have on the 4 plus t level, when the metric is split like that, corresponds to the power law equations, to the Einstein scalar field equations. So what we have done here is we have set up the conformal initial value problem on the 4 plus t level, starting from the initial value problem on this four-dimensional level. Now we use the result on the 4 plus t level, meaning we know that the conformal initial value problem is well posed on this level, and that therefore the constructed data A hat and B hat uniquely evolves into unique future asymptotically simple solution of the Einstein equations with cosmological constant, whose boundary is the manifold scry plus hat. Okay. The metric G hat possesses the expansions of the type we had before. And yeah, this A hat and B were the data, the free, the specifiable coefficients. So in my scheme, we are now still 2/3. Just have to reduce the result here. So what you have to show is that the asymptotically simple solution M hat reduces to an asymptotically simple solution M G tilde phi. We can do this explicitly. So by construction, M hat G hat is asymptotically simple, so there exists some omega such that omega squared g hat is smooth at scry plus hat. So if we just plug in what we have here, we plug in the 4 plus d split, so the g hat was g plus e to the 2 phi over d times the delta, which we just write out in a little bit more fancy way, expand it. And then we apply Kaluza-Klein reduction. We try to find out from this metric here what it corresponds to on the four-dimensional level. So what we do first is we check what the field is. The field must be here in the second term, so it must be that one. So the conformally scaled field is this here. And we can use this to look what the metric is on this level. So it must be e to the phi times g. So it's e to the, in this case, phi prime, because we are on the conformally rescaled level, times the first part here. And if one just makes the computation, one sees that the g prime then is omega time to the power of 2 plus t times the g tilde. So that's exactly what we had for our definition of asymptotic simplicity for the manifold mg tilde phi for the power law inflation space-time. Okay. Essentially, we're done. I just want to give the asymptotic expansions explicitly. So we have seen that the asymptotic expansions look like the following on the 4 plus d level when we reduce it partly. And we can make a coordinate transformation. I don't want to go into the details here, but essentially we get this what I already had on one slide for the theorem. When we do the coordinate transformation, we get that the metric for the power law inflation model is some kind of Laplace function, which does to first order not depend on t, plus the spatial part, which has a leading term like the power law model and an expansion here that contains, as the first term, the initial data. So summing up, nonlinear stability of the sitter reduces, in a way, to nonlinear stability of power law inflation. I mean now the homogeneous to nonlinear stability of the homogeneous isotropic model I've introduced. Okay, just the same thing again in other words. So again, to summarize the theorem, so if we now have initial data which is sufficiently close to data characterizing the homogeneous and isotropic model, then the evolution of this data yields a space-time that's globally close to that model, and such space-times possess metrics and scalar fields that have asymptotic expansions of the kind I've shown. Okay, so the main part is finished, I think. I'm tempted to make some remarks about the result we used, the hard result, tough stability of the sitter part. Just a few remarks, actually, but the ones which I find which were most interesting for me somehow. So we used here that the sitter space-time is nonlinearly stable in even dimensions, so in n plus 1 dimension when n is odd. The proof, as I said, is based on this results by Helmut Friedrich, Michael Anderson, and others. It is based on one basic observation, namely, if a metric gamma, I should say this is a metric, if a metric gamma solves the Einstein equations with a cosmological constant, then gamma solves some kind of conformal Einstein equations, which can be abbreviated here, like h of gamma is 0, a kind of operator here, which is quite of high degree when dimension is high. So this operator is conformally invariant, which is the most important point here. And this makes it possible to prove the well-posedness of the conformal initial value problem. But this is somehow the core. And the techniques resemble very much the proof of the closeness of the norm of the Cauchy problem, standardly, like hyperbolic reduction and stuff. So I was interested in somehow where does one find this tensor H, and why should be the case when n is not odd but even be so different. And to give you a flavor of that, so what we do here is consider space-time in dimension n plus 1, metric in Gaussian coordinates, and we just give now gamma the spatial metric as a series expansion, which we had before, like the Sitter expansion. So we can make here some other coordinate choice, and it looks like that. From this, we see very easily that this is asymptotically simple. If we multiply this metric by tau squared, this becomes smooth and smoothly extendable through conformal infinity. So the main thing is now the following. If the dimension, dimension minus one is odd, then metrics of this type here solve the Einstein equations with lambda up to arbitrary order. If n is even, this is not true. They solve the Einstein equations only up to order n minus 1, coefficient n minus 1. Then we have to add logarithmic terms to be able to solve the equations. So terms like this, log tau, tau to the n. And this term appearing in front of the logarithm here can be also understood as a failure of the series to satisfy the Einstein equations. Now we can write it like that here. Failure to satisfy at order n. So if this was zero, then this was, I mean, if it was Einstein vacuum with cosmological constant, this would be zero. But here it's only zero to order n minus one, and the next one is not zero. So this is called obstruction tensor typically. So it obstructs smoothness at scry because we have these logarithmic additions. Okay, this is some detail so one can calculate this obstruction tensor, and it turns out that it looks like the following we had before. It depends only on the initial data conformal infinity, on what is here the zero coefficient of the mid of the expansion here.
It provokes, of course, a question, where does one find these lower order terms? I've always seen the first order terms, but never the lower order terms.
I calculated some. It's hard. So one can do, I mean, I not exactly here, but for the power law stuff, and I mean, it's no use. What for? But when one does the computation, they turn up, of course. So one needs
for
10.
For general n. Well,
for general n, yes. Yes. I mean, actually, here n is even now. I mean, in the case n is even. Because in the case n is odd, there are no logarithmic terms. So,
yes.
So n is even here at the moment. I mean, as it must be. I mean, here one sees that there's n minus 2, whatever. This should be.
What order have you calculated?
It depends. No. It depends. So I calculated some to see whether they show up in the full equation. So one must be sure which terms are negligible and which not. But I don't mean that I calculated all to any order n. So I think I looked at I looked at power law. So I don't really remember. It would correspond to n equals 4, I think. Yes, the simplest stuff. N equals 4.
Mm-hmm. I think n equals 6 is in Skenderis' paper, in the paper by Skenderis.
Probably, yes.
N equals 6, so there is an explicit formula in a paper by Skenderis.
Okay, this operator, this tensor, is conformally invariant, some weight. I could go through this explicitly, it's quite easy. Maybe I don't show this. So very importantly, everything here is independent of the signature of this gamma zero. So signature doesn't enter in all the considerations here. Okay. So now suppose that the metric gamma here satisfy Stanton equations with a cosmological constant on a space-time with dimension n plus 1, as before, and n is now odd. We define a manifold which is of one dimension higher. We call it whatever, curly M, R cross M. So there is some fracture n plus 1 is n plus 1 plus 1. So this new n here is now even. And on this space, which is now one dimension higher, we define a metric in the following way. T to the minus 2, dt squared plus a function of t times the gamma. If we do it like that, then M, which we started with here, can be interpreted as conformal boundary of this curly M. I mean, simply from the form. This is asymptotic simplicity again. And gamma here is the metric induced on conformal infinity. So it is the zeroth coefficient of an expansion of this fracture G. If we write it out like I did here, so we have tt squared and the zeroth coefficient and some kind of series, but we have it explicitly here, so it's tt squared plus gamma and two more terms. So g0 is the gamma. And now one can show that this fracture g satisfies the Einstein equations with the cosmological constant in n plus one dimensions. And this n, as I said, is now even because it's this n is this n plus one. Okay, it satisfies the equations. This means it doesn't fail to solve them. And that's the main point. So this g does not fail to solve the Einstein equations. But actually it could. It could, but this, as it doesn't, the obstruction tangent must vanish. And I mean, equivalent argument, one could say this expansion here doesn't contain logarithmic terms. Since it doesn't contain logarithmic terms, this cry is smooth, and this obstruction tensor must be zero. So this is, for me, the core of the whole idea of this obstruction argument, this conformal equation, where it comes from. And in brief, what we have seen here now was if the gamma satisfies the Einstein equation with lambda on an n plus 1 dimensional spacetime n odd, then it follows that the obstruction tensor of that gamma is zero. So, and here one sees why it cannot work if you start out with even dimensions. If you started out with an n plus 1 dimensional spacetime n even, then when we go through the same argument, we get the spacetime fracture n plus 1, n plus 1 plus 1, which has no obstruction to smooth Knibel's cry whatsoever. So when there's no obstruction to smoothness, there can nothing can vanish. So there is no object there that could replace this conformal object we have in the even dimensions. So stability of even dimensional Zeta space can be proved because odd dimensional solutions in general exhibit obstructions to the smoothness of cry. So in this sense, obstructions to the smoothness are beneficial for the proof of other things. So finally, I would maybe try to answer how the same thing looks like in power law. Now, this was really old Einstein with lambda. And so we've seen here that Einstein equations, cosmological constant, I make it a 4 plus t split, but this doesn't matter. So if t was even, there was no obstruction, no logarithms, and the nonlinear stability could be proved with these conformal methods. And the same was true for the power law inflation model, because we could do this Kaluza-Klein correspondence, this oxidation reduction. If t is odd, there is an obstruction, there are logarithms appearing, expansions, and nonlinear stability is not proved yet. The same happens here. I didn't show this now, but it's somehow clear from the Kaluza-Klein reduction, there will be logarithms appearing also here in expansions of the power law inflation models. So, but one can ask now, because power law is a little bit more flexible, we don't have just d even and d odd. Maybe I find the slice again. Yeah. So in power law inflation, this factor here can be arbitrary, it's a continuum. But here we have chosen just a sequence, according to these even numbers. So what happens if I choose lambda not according to this formula here? And to make a long story short, one can do this at least on the level of formal power series. So some result is due to Müller-Schmidt and Staurobinsky, who tried to do this already. They did it in Gaussian coordinates, and they found a lot of logarithmic terms. But we somehow think we know better, because we know about this Kaluza-Klein stuff and how a metric of a power law inflation model should be written in the best way. And that's probably here, like we did in the Kaluza-Klein reduction, a factor here, a conformal rescaling of some other stuff, where the conformal factor is involved, is essentially the scalar field to in the exponent of the E function. If one does that, one finds that the logarithms found by these other authors are actually not genuine. They disappear because we chose somehow better coordinates. And you don't need to care about the details, but it means essentially that we don't find any obstruction here. There will be no logarithms for non-integer d's. Is this good or bad? This is bad if one wants to prove non-linear stability. There's no obstructions. We have no objects that could vanish. There are no conformal invariant equations that we could use. And if I would prove something now, I would rather prove that this is the only case where these conformal equations really appear like that. Michael Anderson told me that it seems to be a proof. Some people might know better. That at least in the series of even odd, I mean in the natural numbers, they're the only conformal invariants that one can find. And in odd dimensions, they simply don't exist. And I would think that this can be generalized. All the non-integer dimensions, those conformal invariant tensors do not exist. So one has to come up with a quite new method if one wants to prove nonlinear stability of more general models. And I think that's essentially all I have to say. This is Helmut is the best person to answer that, but it comes from the bipartisanness of the conformal initial value problem. So you can only guarantee that the initial data, I mean, it's smooth dependence or continuous dependence on initial data. So you have a bipartisan problem, you choose initial data which you know that it evolves globally to the past or future, whatever, and you know that the initial data which is close to it, sufficiently close, whatever this sufficient is, you can specify it in numbers, of course. When it's sufficiently close, then the evolution must follow the original trajectory.
Exactly, but that's sufficiently close for, I mean, the hyperbolic system should be some subluxury.
I can perhaps comment on this. Michael Anderson, in his original paper, shows that his equations are well posed using pseudo-differential techniques. And if you do this, then you're essentially staying the C infinity class. Mm. But so the work I did with him afterwards, then the equations, we show that this set of equations were posed in subluxury spaces. So you can just use.
So I don't remember the exponents in the sub, but I mean also in the original.
So then in the statement.
Of course. That's .
Okay.
I have one question. So this RD factor, I never understood how that relates to the scalar field. Is the scalar field? I got the impression that you end up with a bunch of scalar fields, but so. Technically, what is the relation?
So there are probably ways of there are ways of extending it, but I mean this is somehow the simplest approach. So this is a choice here. So if you choose here really a product of M cross the RD, you choose the metric like that. You have a flat part and a conformal factor. So the scalar field appears here as some kind of conformal factor of the group part of the total space of the RD, where the RD is this Lie group. I mean, very simplified here. So it appears as, I mean, as you say, in general Kaluza-Klein, you can have a multiplet, many scalar fields. But here we just use one in the sense, so we restrict it by definition to flat metric times a function. And this function is then a scalar field, which can be interpreted as the scalar field in four dimensions.
But can this method then be generalized to cover, I think there are inflationary models where you have indeed many scalar fields.
They can essentially, but they don't give much new results. I mean, one can. I think so. Yeah. So we didn't look into it in detail, but so there is this two fields where one. Yeah, Alan knows better about all this inflation stuff, of course. But we didn't pursue this further. But one can also show, I suppose, stability if one has two scalar fields. But then they must be in a certain, again, they must somehow come from twice a reduction from the sitter. So one could somehow think of doing two reductions like that and generalize it in that way. But we didn't write up anything with them.
So we tried to look at this and we didn't find an interesting case, which was more general, but this might only be due to our ignorance of the literature. Maybe there is
It's clear that you can just repeat this method for any Kaluza-Klein reduction, whether it's abelian or non-abelian, as long as you have one global solution near which you'll be able to function, right? So your undot is abelian and all scalar fields equal, but
precisely.
As long as you have one single solution which has a smooth compactification with whatever the Kaluza-Klein part, then you'll get stability by this.
Okay.